Okay, so I guess we should get started again. So before I go into the lecture, I just want to warn you, I woke up in a much different time zone. So if I fall asleep, please just turn the lights out and leave quietly. So hopefully I'll get through the lecture, but we'll see. The other problem with jet lag is I managed to forget the little Mac video connector thing, so I'll just be doing the lecture using a PDF viewer, and I won't be able to give examples through the lecture, but maybe we can do some things on the board. Okay. So I promised at the last programming lecture 2 weeks ago lots of examples of programming with lists and recursion and data structures, so we'll get into that today. So basically, so far we've talked about the proof search behavior of rules without any sort of self-reference or recursive calls, and that simplifies things a lot. So in this lecture, I'm going to explain how things start to work when you do have recursive predicates, and how proof search works, and how you can avoid sort of subtle non-termination bugs, or how you can make it more likely that your program does something useful in a reasonable amount of time. And also, that opens up the ability to do a lot more useful sort of basic operations on lists, which you can't really do without recursion. So we'll spend probably a third of the lecture, the second half of the lecture, talking about list processing. And so hopefully that'll be, you know, you'll have seen similar things in perhaps previous courses on functional programming or regular imperative programming. But list programming in Prolog has a slightly different flavor. And I'll show examples. So in particular, because you're writing relations, you can actually write programs like append that you can run both in the forward direction and in the backward direction. So you can say, take two lists and glue them together and get the appended list. Or you can say, take one list and split it apart into two lists that, when appended, give you back the original list. And that lets you, and using the same code. So there are some subtleties attached to that involving thinking about when different terms are ground, that is, when they've been bound to terms, or when variables are just variables, that I'll talk about a bit. And finally, a sort of a generalization of the list processing, I'll talk a bit about programming with other kinds of terms as data structures. Okay, so far we've mostly used programs or rules that are not recursive, that is, there's no reference to the rule in the head of the clause, in the body of that clause, or transitively in the definitions of any of the rules in the bodies of the clauses used in the rule. So, in other words, so far we've done things like P if QR, and maybe R if S. I mean, I think maybe Alan has talked about recursive rules in the lectures, but I haven't yet. But we haven't done things like P if R and R if P. So this would be a simple example of recursion. Okay, so without recursion, the class of programs that we can actually write is pretty limited. So for example, if we have a relation already defined, and we want to define, say we have a parent relation, and we want to define the ancestor relation from it, we can't, because we need to be able to refer to the ancestor relation in its own definition. To define the transitive closure of a relation, we need recursion. And so also the kinds of programs we can write are actually a lot closer to things like database queries. So there are various kinds of computations that we just can't do, besides simple things like transitive closure. So it's not computationally complete. So okay, well, you know, if you just write down recursive rules in Prolog, well, it lets you, and it will try to solve them. So for example, if we want to define the ancestor relation in terms of a parent relation, we can just say, okay, X is an ancestor of Y if X is a parent of Y. That's the base case. And we can also have a rule that says X is an ancestor of Y if there's some Z. So Z is only mentioned on the right hand side of the rule. So that really sort of means there exists some Z that is a parent of X, and Z is an ancestor of Y, right? So your great-grandparent is a parent of your grandparent, and your grandparent is an ancestor of you, right? So, you know, we just stick this occurrence of the predicate over here, and everything should work. And it does, actually. This is the right definition of ancestor. But the point I want to make here is that There are several different ways we could write something that would be logically equivalent but would have different operational behavior. So if you think about what would happen if we have some, say, parent if we have some basic facts that define some parent relationships, then what will happen is we'll say, okay, if we want to know parent of ancestor of say of variables x and y, then we might say, okay, well, the first rule applies, x and y can be unified with x and y, and the body holds with parent being equal to ab. So then we'd get x equals a, y equals b. And if we ask for more answers, then the first rule will match again using the second parent clause. So we'll get x equals b, y equals c. And then if we ask for a third solution, we'll get we've run out of ways to solve the ancestor goal with the first clause. And we'll use the second clause. And the second clause says, OK, first, see if we can find, matching x with x up there and y with y up there. First, see if we can find a z such that parent x z holds. And then see if ancestor of z y holds. OK, so solving the parent subgoal, again, we have parent a, b. And so then all we need to know is to show, that ancestor of b, c holds. And we can derive that using the first rule again. So we ultimately would get x equals a, y equals c for the third answer. And if we ask for more answers, then there aren't going to be any because the only other way to solve the second rule would be to use the second parent fact for the parent subgoal. And then there aren't any ancestors. There aren't any y's such that ancestor of CY holds. That is, there aren't any ways to derive that. Okay, so that's just an example, but I wanted to emphasize that basically we're picking rules to apply and picking facts in the database in the program to try to use in a in the order they're given in the program or in the order they're listed in as subgoals, and that means that if we change the order, then we could get different behavior. So in particular, if we have a simple program where we say, okay, p holds if p holds, and p holds, right? So if you think about it logically, then this is, well, A, kind of stupid, but B, so p should hold, right? I mean, the second rule says it definitely holds, and the first rule says if p, then p, which is really a tautology. So it shouldn't change the meaning of the program. But what the Prolog interpreter will do to try to solve this is to say, okay, if you ask, okay, does p hold, it says, okay, well, I know how to do that. I'll use this rule. All right. So now does p hold? Oh, I know how to do that. I'll use this rule. And does p hold? Oh, I know how to do that. And so, you know, this is going to go on for a while. On your computer, eventually, you'll run out of memory, but this is an infinite loop. So you don't want to write rules like that. And more generally, you don't want to write rules that have sort of left recursion or recursion, recursive calls before sort of base case calls. So let me illustrate what happens if you reorder the rules. So here's a second version of the ancestor relation, where I've basically taken the same two rules we had before and just swapped the order. So this is analogous to the P of P and P example. Basically, we'll try to solve this goal by saying, okay. It isn't directly analogous, but so basically, the difference is the difference here is that this will try to find the longest sort of chain between x and y first, which may not always be what you want. So this, I think, reordering the rules shouldn't change the termination behavior, or at least it doesn't in this case, in the fragment of Prolog we looked at so far. But it might change the efficiency of the program. So we'll say, okay, instead of noticing first that parent AB and parent BC directly give you ancestor AB and ancestor BC. Instead, the system will say, okay, well, I know to derive ancestor, it's okay, it's enough to find a parent, a Z that's a parent in between X and Y, and then find an ancestor. So it'll sort of keep expanding until it runs out of alternatives. So in this finite program, in this finite database, that doesn't make any difference determination, but it might take longer to get an answer. So the heuristic that this suggests is to write the rules defining the base cases first. And that's actually, for me at least, that's actually the more natural way to write them anyway, because it's easier to think about what happens for the base case. So this is actually illustrating what I was trying to say just now. So if we ask, okay, is A an ancestor of B? Then if we've got this definition of the ancestor relation, then we'll start by saying, okay, well, we can solve that by finding a Z such that A is a parent of Z and Z is an ancestor of B. And then the first subgoal we can solve by taking Z equal to B, that matches this first fact here. But then we're stuck because now we need to derive ancestor BB, and there isn't anything that lets us derive that. On the other hand, if we make the other guess and say, okay, maybe Z is B, that is using this the second node over here is using the first rule that says ancestor XY if parent XY. Okay, so if we use that rule, then we're done. And so the point is that in this case, we spent maybe, you know, an extra two steps that we didn't need to spend looking on this side of the proof search tree for an answer that didn't turn out to work. So the sort of reason for the heuristic of using the base cases first is that base cases are likely to be less work to compute if you can solve the goal by filling in the base case. If the interpreter can solve the goal by finding by using the smaller rules in the base case, then the amount of work needed to find the first solution will probably be smaller. But that's just a heuristic. Okay, so the other reordering that I mentioned before is that the other order dependency is that the order in which you list the goals in the body of a clause can also affect the behavior of the program, because the program is basically solving these goals in the order they're listed here. Okay, so in particular, so let's say we keep the original order of the rules, but we say, okay, to find an ancestor of to show that X is an ancestor of Y, find a Z such that Z is an ancestor of Y, and then check that Z is a X is a parent of Z. Okay, so this is sort of a little bit dangerous looking, I think, to me at least, because it's saying, you know, defining something directly in terms of the predicate without any kind of guards that force you to make progress. So in particular, what this will do is it will actually find all the solutions, but then if you ask for more solutions, it will always be able to use this rule to expand and keep searching. So that may give you non-termination behavior that if the program is used as part of another program that's trying to enumerate solutions, then this might not give you what you want. Okay, and so as you might guess, there's a fourth combination I'll look at. And so this is especially bad. So this is saying, okay, if we do the recursive call first, if we write the recursive rule first in the program, and also the first thing the rule does is a recursive call, then basically now we're back in this, you know, PFP scenario. Because this, if you give any terms X and Y to fill in up here, you know, if you're solving a goal ancestor for T1, T2, you'll always be able to match X to T1 and Y to T2, and then keep solving, you know, ancestor 4 with, then you have to solve ancestor 4 with Z being some free variable and Y being bound to T2. And so you can basically keep going forever. So this will never give you any useful answers. So the heuristic that this suggests is to try to guard the recursive goals in a recursive predicate definition with non-recursive goals that force some work to get done, for example, some variables to get bound to terms. Okay? Right, so this is illustrating that, I think. So this is basically what I just said. If we start with x and y here, then we can always expand this first subgoal using the first rule. And basically, we're never going to be able to finish. Okay, so also, as I presented a couple of weeks ago, or in the first lecture, you know, we don't just have variables and constants in Prolog, we also have terms that can be nested arbitrarily deep. So to do useful things with those kinds of terms, we need to write recursive predicates. So one simple example is we can actually say, okay, we can think of the natural numbers in a sort of unary representation as basically sequences of, you know, either 0 or successor of 0 is 1 or successor of 0 is 2 and so on. So this, you might have seen this in a discrete math class at some point. And to do interesting things with these operations, we need recursion. So for example, if we want to define the predicate that relates two unary numbers with their sum or their product, the sort of basic arithmetic operations, we need to write recursive predicates. So we can define addition, for example, by saying, okay, so given two numbers, n1 and n2, so the way to read this is the sum of this number and this number is this number. Okay? So in particular, if the first number is 0, then 0 plus anything is anything, right? It's, nothing happens. Very easy. And if what we're adding, if the first thing we're adding is n plus 1 for some number n, then it's enough to figure out what n plus m are and call that p, and then say, okay, n plus 1 plus m is the same as, let me... Let me maybe translate it into a little bit more familiar notation. So you might say, okay, so basically the recursive subgoal, when it succeeds, is going to give us some number p that such that p is equal to n plus m. So the rule is basically saying to calculate n plus 1 plus m, it's enough to figure out what n plus m is and then add 1 to that. So this plus 1 here is represented by the successor term. Okay? So, but unlike a definition in a sort of functional language, you can actually say, okay, if I don't know n and m, but I do know p, then tell me what solutions this addition problem has. So what numbers n and m, if you add them together, will give you p. So I mean, right, so basically enumerating solutions, you know, if p is 5, then you get 0 and 5, 1 and 4, 2 and 3, 3 and 2, and so on. And similarly, you can use this to say when a natural number in this unary representation is less than or equal to another one by saying, okay, m is less than or equal to n if there's some number which we won't give a name to but just write as underscore, or if there's some other number that if we add it to m, we get n, right? So that's a sensible definition of less than or equal to for natural numbers, because you can only because they're all positive, basically. So this underscore is basically a special variable symbol that matches that stands for an anonymous variable. So if you use multiple underscores in a term, they'll all get renamed to different things, unlike if you use multiple x's in a term. Okay. Okay, so similarly, building on this addition example, we can define a recursion multiplication predicate that says, okay, given two of these unary numbers, let's multiply them together. So, for example, obviously multiplying 0 by any number is going to be 0 again. And multiplying the successor of multiplying, well, I'll write it out in the sort of standard arithmetic notation. If we have n plus 1 times m, that's really the same as n times m plus n. Okay. So what the body of the rule is saying is first find some q, which find the quantity we'll call q, which is what we get by multiplying n and m together. And then have I got that wrong? Yeah, that should be m. And then take q and add it to m using the addition predicate we already have, and then we get the final product result is going to be p. Okay? So this illustrates, and I mean, which is probably not surprising, but this illustrates that you can, you know, call recursive predicates from other recursive predicates. And similarly, we can define a predicate that says whether a number is a square, right? Whether it's equal to some other natural number multiplied by itself, just by saying, okay, something's a square if there's some, we can read the n on this side as being existentially quantified. So a square is something such that there exists some other number such that m is equal to n times n, okay? And unfortunately, I can't demonstrate it because I can't connect my laptop, but I mean, you can write this predicate and say, okay, show me all squares, and it will enumerate, you know, 0 is a square, 1 is a square, 4 is a square, 9 is a square, just by basically applying the rules blindly. Okay, so I'm going to move on to list processing now, so that, but actually some of the, basically the same kinds of ideas crop up right away in the list processing setting, except that the natural numbers are very simple data structures, and the lists are very simple data structures with extra data glued to them at each point. So in other words, there's sort of a list of length 0, and there's a list of length n plus 1 that has some data attached to it. Okay. And so if you have two lists, you can define a predicate that concatenates them or appends the two lists together. And this is really the same pattern of recursion as in the add predicate before. So this is saying, okay, if we have the empty list, that is, list of length 0, then appending that to any other list has no effect. And if we have a list that's the result of consing some term x onto some other list L, then appending to M will give us x cons n if appending L and M gives us n. Okay? So, I mean, maybe these seem like baby steps here, but I think it's good to sneak up on these kinds of problems gradually. So, okay, so again, I can't demonstrate this, but the operational behavior of this is going to be, well, so first, certainly, if we have, if we pass in two lists, 1, 2, and 3, 4, right? Then, well, we definitely ought to get something like x equals 1, 2, 3, 4. And how we would get that is we would say, okay, well, so this list, I think I mentioned this before, but let me reiterate it. This list notation is really equivalent to this notation, which is also really internally equivalent to something like dot 1, dot 2, empty list. Okay, so this third thing is a little bit more like a kind of a Lisp style car and header notation, if you're familiar with Lisp. And the first line is more what you would this shows more directly how this how the term will match the rules in the definition of a pen. So basically we'll say, okay, first, if x is equal to the list 1, 2, that's really this. So first, the second rule will apply, and we have to figure out what we get by appending two cons nil with m, which is 3, 4. And then if we keep going, then eventually then the same rule will apply, and we'll need to figure out what we get by appending nil with 3, 4, and that will be 3, 4. So then popping back up, we'll put the 2 at the beginning of the list, and then finally we'll put the 1 at the beginning of the list. Okay? So in the forward direction, hopefully that's not surprising. In the backward direction, if you say, okay, I know the list that I want to get at the end, the results of the append, but I don't know what the lists that I'm appending are, then you'll get something like, basically you'll get all, I think, 5 different ways of splitting this list into 2 lists that append back to give you 1, 2, 3, 4. So you should get something like x equals empty, y equals 1, 2, 3, 4. Or x equals 1, y equals 2, 3, 4. Or several more solutions, or eventually x equals 1, 2, 3, 4, y equals empty. So you might remember I mentioned this sort of programming strategy called generate and test at, I think, at the end of the second lecture. And this is an example of something where you might maybe have some complicated problem involving different overlapping lists, and you might imagine writing a generator that says, okay, here's what I want the whole list to be at the end, and maybe some other constraints involving appending lists. And so you might write a generator involving append and then write a test predicate that tells you whether the solution you've got whether the candidate solution you're looking at is really a solution. So the point here being that these programs really can be read either in a sort of forward direction as functions or in a backward direction as sort of calculating sets of solutions. Okay, so connected to that, there's a convention that's often used in Prolog documentation or program comments that tells you something about the ways the program is expected or the predicate is expected to be used. So these are called mode annotations. So for example, the forward direction of append would typically be written as append plus plus minus. So this is a little, it's not really a code, it doesn't have meaning internally in Prolog, but it's a notation that people often use to describe what the program might do. So the plus means that this argument is expected to be ground, or that if the argument is ground when the predicate is called, if the plus arguments are ground when the predicate is called, then the minus argument will be ground when the predicate succeeds. Let me try and say that again because I think I made a mess of it. So think of, for example, in this forward, over here, in this forward direction of append, what I mean by ground is that we have a term with no variables. I should have defined that first. So here, this is an example of append being called in mode plus plus minus, because plus here means this term is ground and this term is ground, the two pluses. And minus means this term doesn't have to be ground, so it could be a variable or it could be a term that has variables in it. And so the claim, the meaning of this informally is that if you fill in ground things for the plus arguments, then when the predicate succeeds, if it does, then the minus terms will also be filled in. So why is this interesting? I mean, when do you have So if the predicate is really defining a function, then you could sort of think of it as, you know, you always make the input arguments plus and the output arguments could be minus. But there are other situations where it's not really a function that that these mode annotations can be useful. So for example, this use of append is saying, okay, I've given you in the third argument, plus refers to this term being ground. So this notation is saying if the third argument is ground when you call the thing, then the first two arguments will be bound to ground, will be filled in with ground terms when the call succeeds. So and also there's often a question mark annotation that means it doesn't matter or basically could refer to either a plus or minus argument. Okay, so maybe let me pause there before running too far ahead and see if there are any questions. So we'll have some more list processing examples now. Okay, everybody seems at least as alert as I am, so that's good. We can also define a membership predicate. So this you could also use, for example, to enumerate solutions or elements of a list in a sort of generate and test search strategy. When is something a member of a list? Well, it's a member, X is a member of a list if X is the first thing in the list. That's easy. And otherwise, well, this is, these two rules aren't really mutually exclusive, but basically this is saying, well, it's clearly in the list if it's right at the beginning, and it's also in the list if it's in the tail of the list. It could be in the list more than once, and in that case, you'll get more than one answer. So the typical modes you would use this is either if you know both the element in the list and you want to check, or if you just know the list and you want to find, you want to enumerate all the elements of the list in some larger search problem. What would happen if you had, if you called member with a ground term in the first argument and a variable in the second argument? Well, actually, maybe it's good to work that one out because it's because it's halfway through the lecture, and maybe it would be good to get a little bit more interactive. Okay, so let's say I ask the system to tell me what lists are, what lists contain 5. What's going to happen?
It's going to look at the first element of 5.
Sorry, I couldn't quite hear.
Is it going to look at the first element of L?
Yeah, so, well, the first rule applies, right? So we'll say, okay, match the goal we're trying to solve with mem x x cons underscore, and that has a solution, so we could say x equals 5 and underscore equals L. And so then we'll get another goal. Oh, so then we'll be done, right? Then we're done. So we'll sorry, I got that. L should be it will be x cons some freshly generated variable, let me call it y. Okay, and x was 5. So we'll get an answer that says, okay, the only thing that we cared about in the goal was L, and so L, one solution is if 5 is right at the beginning of the list. Okay. So that's good, we find one solution. What if we want more solutions? Well, we can backtrack and say, okay, is there another way of solving this rule other than the solution we just did. So how will we try to solve it? Well, we've already tried the first rule and that worked, so we shouldn't try that again because that would be redundant. So we'll try the second rule. And the second rule also matches the goal we're trying to solve. So we'll get a unifier that says x equals 5 and l equals. So we have to freshen the names of the variables inside the rule to avoid conflict. So have x prime in be the x in the rule and l prime be the l in the rule, and I'll use l for this l. So the list we're interested will be some freshly generated variable, I'll call it y, times l prime. And now we need to solve the subgoal that's on the right-hand side of the rule. So that will be is 5 a member of L prime, right? Okay, so this should worry you a bit because this looks a lot like this one, right? It's just a different variable, but they're both free variables. So this kind of suggests that, you know, drawing the proof search tree. So this is a kind of example of a proof search tree. There is more examples of this in the Learn Prologue Now book. I've been using this similar notation. The proof search tree describes shows the states that you visit in the proof, and also which unification steps and maybe which rules link let you go from one state to another. So if I zoom out a bit from this proof search tree, then basically it sort of looks like this, okay? Where, when we go from this node to this node, we basically have the same goal. So we'll wind up with basically the proof search tree will just be an infinite sort of an infinite list with single nodes hanging off to the left at each point. Okay, so in other words, this means that if you ask a membership predicate like this with a non-ground list, then it will keep trying to find longer and longer lists that mention x. Okay, and so that, touching back on what we talked about involving recursion at the beginning of the lecture, so you know, if you ignore the term parts of the goals, this kind of looks like a bad program because it defines membership directly in terms of itself. So the important thing here is that the termination behavior and the usefulness of the predicate also has a lot to do with correctly sort of taking apart, making progress by taking apart data structures that are passed in. So one additional heuristic about programming with recursion and term data structures is to try to identify a term that you're going to be using as sort of the induction parameter or the thing that you're taking apart that ensures that eventually you'll take the whole thing apart and terminate. And so that thing will often need to be ground. So for example, in this membership example, in the modes here for membership, both of the useful modes I've given have the list being assumed to be ground. So we're always going to try to terminate by taking the list apart. There's not very much we can do with the X part that we're asking whether it's a membership, because we don't know anything about what those things could be. Okay? Right, so just to round out the set of standard list operations, we can remove elements from lists. So this predicate says, okay, given X and given a list, give me another list that has exactly one copy of X pulled out of it. Okay? So the base case says, well, if X is at the beginning of the list, then it's easy to remove exactly one copy. We just remove that one and return L. And the recursive case says if there's something at the beginning of the list, call it Y, which might or might not be X, we don't care, then try to remove X from L, from the sublist L, and get M, which is L with X removed, and then glue that back together with Y to form a copy of the original list with X, with one copy of X removed. Okay? So this also, if there's more than one copy of X in the list, this will be able to generate multiple solutions, right? So if, let's say the list is 1, 2, 1, 3, 1, and we remove one from that, then we should get, I guess, three answers, right? One would be L equals 2, 1, 3, 1, L equals 1, 2, 3, 1, and the third one, which you can probably fill in yourself. Not write it out. L equals 1, 2, 1, 3. So, again, touching on this observation about thinking about modes and groundness and how to ensure that these predicates terminate. Here, there are two lists here, so we could maybe imagine doing induction on either one of them. But actually, the first list, it makes more sense to think of remove as taking a ground thing and a ground list and giving you back a ground list with something removed. Imagine what would happen if we maybe gave a ground thing for X and a ground thing for the third list, for the return list, for the removed list, but didn't say what the list we're removing from is. Well, then that would basically try to fill in X anywhere in the list that it could go, which, you know, you might want to do, but I guess that would also give you a reasonable mode as well. That would be a plus minus plus mode for this. Okay. So next, a slightly more complicated example is a predicate that basically is doing traversing two list data structures at the same time. So in this case, this predicate is taking two lists that are going to be assumed to be of the same length. And for each pair of elements that are in corresponding positions, they're going to be glued together by as an explicit pair. So if the two lists are empty initially, then the zip of the two lists is going to be empty. And if the two lists both start with an element, then we essentially zip the two sublists together to get N, and then glue the pair of X and Y together and put that at the beginning of N. Okay, so you might have seen a similar function in language like Haskell or ML or Lisp in functional programming. And so this basically is having the same effect. So in the forward mode, this is taking two lists and sort of zipping them together, putting together corresponding pairs. But also you might be familiar with an unzip operation that takes a list of pairs and splits it into a pair of lists. And actually this does that operation with the same code, but with a different mode. So if you give the third list as a ground argument, then it will figure out how, you know, basically just by applying these rules, it will take the two lists apart and take the list of pairs apart and give you back the two lists. Okay. So now maybe as a probably almost last exercise, let's think about how to write a predicate that takes a list or maybe a list that contains lists or lists that contains lists of lists and so on, and tries to flatten it out into a single big list. Okay, so this is kind of alternatively, you could think of this as taking a tree data structure and flattening it into a list. So, whoops. Let's see. All right, I think that's disappeared. Well, let's just do it on the board then. Okay, so following the strategy, I suggested before of looking at the base case first. Well, the base case of a list of lists of lists of lists would just be an empty list. So if we flatten the empty list, then we should get empty list, yeah. Okay, so now suppose we have a list that starts with some element, and X also might be a list of lists of lists of lists, and Y might be a list of lists of lists of lists. So how do we flatten this?
Flatten X and Y.
Right. So let me write it like this. So let's first flatten X into some list L1. And Y into some list L2. And then now, well, let me call what we're going to ultimately return L. So how do we get L from L1 and L2? Sure, append would work. Okay, so now we've handled all the cases where either the top level term is the empty list or a cons. So we should have some cases that deal with other things like base data. And so like we could say, okay, if the thing we're flattening isn't a list, then say it's a number one, right, then flattening that should give us the list just containing one. Okay, but we could keep going and write a lot of rules like that and we'd never be done, right? We want to write a single rule that will handle all of these cases. And actually, I haven't told you enough about Prolog's built-in predicates for you to do that, but there's a way to do it. There's actually several ways to do it. But there's one way that is discussed in this week's tutorial, which is basically to say, if X is not something that matches empty list or cons, then we can flatten it to a singleton list containing X. Okay, where a list of X is some predicate that says either X is of this form or X is of that form. Okay, but this negation business, we're going to spend a lot more time talking about that, so I'm just going to